Welcome to Energy Law Roundup, your comprehensive weekly briefing on legal news and developments in the energy industry from Texas and across the country, always in 30 minutes or less. And now, your host for Energy Law Roundup, business litigator and oil and gas trial lawyer, Tom Charlone.
It's the week of April 17th, 2017. Again, my name is Tom Charlone. I'm a litigation partner at Kane Russell, Coleman & Logan, resident in our firm's Houston, Texas office. Overtime claims brought under the Fair Labor Standards Act are rapidly becoming one of the biggest litigation headaches for oil and gas companies and oil field service companies. In a recent victory for the industry earlier this month, Cameron International succeeded in getting a putative FLSA class action thrown out of a San Antonio federal court, based on the simple theory that the named plaintiff was never actually employed by the company. The plaintiff, Jeremy Gardia, alleged that he had worked for Cameron as a flowback operator during a three-month period in 2014. Gardia took the position that Cameron had run afoul of the FLSA to the extent it misclassified flowback operators as salaried and therefore exempt employees, despite the fact that he was a, quote, classic blue-collar worker, according to his complaint. Cameron, for its part, was baffled. It couldn't find a trace of Gardia's employment in its own files and asked the court to bounce the case on this basis. Former Chief District Judge Fred Beery signed off on the report and recommendation from his magistrate judge, which determined that the plaintiff failed to establish that he was at any point a direct employee of Cameron, since he was hired by and paid by a third-party contractor, an individual named Bill Smith. This is, of course, a common theme in the oil patch, the complex web of employees, independent contractors, and people who fall into troublesome gray areas. According to the magistrate's report, quote, Cameron's director of human resources searched the company's employment records using plaintiff's name and social security number, but was unable to locate any record of plaintiff ever being employed. The magistrate judge concluded that, quote, viewing the evidence in a light most favorable to plaintiff, there is insufficient evidence to establish a genuine dispute with regard to whether plaintiff was in fact employed by Cameron. Gardia had argued otherwise, saying that regardless of his technical employment status, Cameron worked in concert with Smith to recruit and train employees who were then, quote, held out as defendants' employees to Cameron's customers. The plaintiff also claimed that Smith informed him that he would be working for Cameron, and additionally, the plaintiff pointed out that he trained for close to a month at a Cameron facility in West Texas. The magistrate judge was still not persuaded. He determined that, quote, plaintiff has not presented any credible facts to establish a joint employer relationship between Bill Smith and Cameron. He claims, for example, that the money paid to him by Smith was supplied by Cameron, but he presents no evidence to support this claim. Given the frequent use by industry participants of independent contractors, staffing services, and other third-party labor arrangements, the decision in Gardia is a good one to keep in your back pocket for the rainy day on which you might find yourself ensnared in an FLSA suit brought by a non-employee in search of a deep pocket. The case is Gardia v. Cameron International Corp., case number 16-CV-00904, in the United States District Court for the Western District of Texas. The relationship between the oil and railroad industries can sometimes be a strained, delicate affair, to put it mildly. Recently, for example, a petroleum trade group petitioned the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals to vacate the Surface Transportation Board's summary dismissal of the group's complaint that BNSF Railway had impermissibly imposed an excessive upcharge for crude oil transported in older tank cars that the railroad considers less safe than tank cars of more recent vintage. The cars at issue, DOT 111 tank cars, have exterior shells that aren't as thick as newer cars. They are not pressurized, and for these and other reasons, some participants in the railroad industry feel that they are not nearly as insulated from crashes as compared to more modernized tank cars. Now, mind you, the DOT 111 tank cars are very much on the approved list of the United States Department of Transportation for purposes of carrying crude oil. That said, these older cars must be retrofitted before being put into service, or, in the alternative, they must be phased out and replaced with newer models in accordance with federal regulations promulgated back in 2015. The petroleum group had this to say in a press release, quote, "The Department of Transportation, not the railroads, are tasked by Congress to establish tank car standards, so BNSF is overstepping its authority by penalizing shippers of oil for using the federally authorized DOT 111 tank cars. The Department of Transportation has approved and deemed the cars safe for use, and a rail company can't supplant the government's decision." The case is American Fuel and Petrochemical Manufacturers v. Surface Transportation Board, case number 17-1112, in the United States Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia. If a pair of U.S. senators have their way, offshore drilling in Alaska will experience a big resurgence by way of rollbacks of cumbersome executive orders that were issued during the Obama administration. The two Republican senators from Alaska report that they have drafted legislation that would scale back former President Barack Obama's executive order that carved out large swaths of the Arctic outer continental shelf from permissible oil and gas leasing. The scuttled region consisted of over 100 million acres in the Arctic and nearly another 4 million acres in the Atlantic Ocean. In particular, Senators Lisa Murkowski and Dan Sullivan announced that they have assembled a sweeping piece of legislation, the Offshore Production and Engineering National Security Alaska Act of 2017. That would reverse the last-minute elimination by the Obama administration of much of the Arctic shelf for mineral leasing. Senator Murkowski had this to say in a press release, quote, "After years of regulatory restrictions and burdens imposed by the Obama administration, this bill charts a much better course for responsible energy production that actually reflects the views of the vast majority of Alaskans. These areas contain prolific resources that can be safely developed to create jobs, reduce our deficits, keep energy affordable, and strengthen national security." Not to be left out, Senator Sullivan issued a statement of his own about the draft legislation. In particular, he was emphatic that former President Obama had tried to, quote, "kill responsible resource development in and around Alaska." To quote the senator, "Oil and gas will be developed in the region, whether by our nation or others. It is imperative that exploration and development occur with all of the safeguards required by the United States to protect the environment and the people who live in the region." We live in a dangerous world. There is no doubt about that. And 9/11 and all that came in its wake is proof positive of the reality in which we still find ourselves in 2017. Nevertheless, a federal judge in Washington, D.C., took a red pen to a majority of an application filed by a subsidiary of Energy Transfer Partners responsible for the Dakota Access Pipeline asking for the redaction of sensitive information from documents produced in discovery during pending litigation, based on the concern that specific information about the location and engineering of the pipeline could be enlisted by terrorists and protest groups to target the pipeline. By way of background, in the waning days and hours of the Obama administration, the Corps of Engineers had refused to approve easements that were necessary to finish the pipeline, and this forms part of the foundation for the current litigation. Regardless, according to the district judge, Energy Transfer had, quote, largely failed to meet its burden to show good cause for such an order. Query whether the trial court is sufficiently in tune with the realities of the world in which we all reluctantly find ourselves in 2017. The case is Standing Rock Sioux Tribe v. United States Army Corps of Engineers, case number 16-CV-01534, pending in the United States District Court for the District of Columbia. In a very interesting case with genuinely huge historical roots, Valero has filed suit against the federal government in a Michigan federal court. The case, filed earlier this month, is rooted in the concept that the government's influence over facilities that provided fuel for the country's military in the Second World War should put the government on the hook for the expenses attendant to the remediation of associated environmental injuries. The lawsuit is predicated on the, I think, reasonable theory that Valero is footing the bill alone for steep cleanup expenses tied to refinery waste, despite the fact that the alleged pollution was a result of the government's war efforts. To quote Valero's pleading, "The Valero companies supported the country in the war effort and were left with the responsibility of addressing contamination and incurring response costs associated with the government's operations at the Valero companies' refineries that are the subject of this action. The Valero companies have requested that the government pay its fair share of these cleanup costs through a negotiated process, but the government has refused." As the Second World War escalated to new heights, the output expectations placed on refineries like Valero's predecessors in interest were truly extraordinary. Valero, being a patriot, was dutifully following orders from Washington and, according to the complaint, is now left holding the bag. According to Valero, quote, "increased manufacturing output often came at the expense of overall efficiency and waste management. This was an expected and intended consequence of the victory at all costs atmosphere surrounding World War II. For example, during the war, the War Production Board controlled approval of the construction of necessary refinery units and equipment, and also defined refinery construction projects relating to pollution control that were deemed non-essential to the war effort." The case is MRP Properties Company, LLC, v. the United States of America, case number 17-CV-11174, pending in the United States District Court for the Eastern District of Michigan.
Thank you for listening to Energy Law Roundup. If you would like additional information about anything from today's episode, you can contact Tom at 210-446-6999 or by email at tom@charlone.net. New episodes of this podcast are available every week on the web at www.energylawroundup.com, your one-stop source for breaking news and developments in energy law.